Hi.
Good
morning.
You know, I wasn't really thinking about what I was going to say because I was really more afraid of what he was going to say about me. So, if I'm any testament to helping another alcoholic, just look at, well, never mind, don't look above. Hi, I'm Ginger, I'm an alcoholic.
I know.
My sobriety date's December 29th, 2003. You know, my story is really not so much about a drunkalogue. It's more of a thinkalogue because my drinking career was very short and not sweet. But what I'll talk about really when I tell my story is about how I felt versus what I did. I was raised in Alabama. Still have a little bit of the twang. I was raised in a family that was kind of like a Leave It to Beaver family. You know, my dad worked. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. I have three brothers. I was the third born. And I do want to say this before I go any further. I'm going to talk about my relationship with my mother, but I do want to tell you that I know that my mother loved me to the best of her ability. And it took me years in the program to really see that. But my mother, her name is Pee-wee. She was 4'11". She's 4'9 now because she's 91 years old. And I was the third born and supposed to be the little frilly little girl, the little mini me. Well, I wasn't. I grew up as a tomboy, big tomboy. And my daddy and I were so close because he thought it was the coolest thing. He just thought it was the coolest thing that I would go fishing with him and hunting with him and roughhouse with him and the boys. And my mother was a little disappointed about that. You know, I didn't fit into her idea of what a little girl, her little girl, was going to be. But she tried, you know, she tried. She dressed me up on Sunday, and if I could get to church without mud or a booger on my dress, she was just tickled to death, you know. Because, and I remember, too, I do have curly hair, but I had this curly hair, and I don't know if any of you remember this far back, but this was I was born in the 50s. You know, she would roll my hair with those pink foam rollers on Sunday night and make me sleep on it. And then she'd get my hair cut, and, you know, I'd feel like a little boy, and I'd be out playing, and then she'd call me in and put in that perm. And, you know, she really tried to make me into this prim, proper little girl, and I just didn't fit in that. But I had a good life. I had a good life. I had brothers that I played with. I had a dad that adored me. My mother loved me, but, you know, I just wasn't that little princess that she thought she was going to have. And, but anyway, it wasn't until I was like in junior high school that boys started noticing me for something other than my tomboyish things. And it wasn't until junior high school that I met other girls that were very athletic, but they were still feminine. It wasn't until junior high school that I felt like I could be who I was, a tomboy, but I could also fit in with having boyfriends and being a cheerleader in high school and wearing all the nice clothes and all that stuff. But there was a part of me that never felt like I was good enough, that I didn't feel like I was meeting the expectations of what my mother wanted from me. my father, like I said, adored me. And it wasn't until I was about 12, I guess, that I realized or I noticed or that my father drank a lot. And he had gone to work for the telephone company. We had moved to Gadsden, Alabama by that time, and he was the manager of the telephone company, and his boss was a raging alcoholic. And so my father started, they used to invite us over, and my dad would drink to keep up with his boss, and I'd never seen that part of my father again before. And so I noticed then that my father started coming home drunk. And I remember my mother telling me once, she said, I remember she used to cry and crawl in bed with me at night because they would fight when he was drunk, and she would cry. And like I said, I'm 9 years old and I'm tall. I'm bigger than my mother at nine, okay? So she's crawling in bed with me and I'm comforting her. And one morning she said, Ginger, I want you to ask your dad to stop drinking because he loves you more than anybody in the world and he'll only do it for you. I was maybe, I don't know how old, I was probably 12. And I did ask him and he didn't stop drinking. And it broke my heart. Because I thought that this person who loved me more than anybody else in the world, according to my mother, didn't love me enough to stop drinking. And so the next few years of my life, I was very active in school. I was a straight-A student. I was a cheerleader. I can tell you that I never, until I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, had a girlfriend. I had acquaintances. But I grew up with boys. I played with boys. I played sports with girls, but they didn't live close to me. The only friends I really had in school were the ones that I saw while I was growing up were girls I saw in church, and they were all wearing their frilly dresses, and they were sitting there prim and proper, and I was sitting with them, but I never really connected with them. There's something about them that I didn't trust. But my father's drinking became a really big problem in our house. And my mother's focus was on my father's drinking. And I'm telling you that he disgusted me. When I would see him drunk, it was the most disgusting thing because he wasn't my dad. And so I had lost respect for my father, and when I would date somebody and I'd come home and my daddy would walk outside drunk and tell the guy to get his hands off of me, and he'd rip my phone. My dad was a manager of a telephone company. I had a phone, my own private line in my room. I can't tell you how many times he would get mad and rip that phone out of the wall, and the next morning I'd wake up and he'd be putting it back in, installing it. But I wanted out of there. Just wanted out of there. Well, there was this boy. And this boy was the boy that everybody wanted. Everybody wanted. And he was good looking. He was wealthy. Came from a wealthy family. And he was what I wanted. And so I dated a few people only because they ran around with him so I could ride in his Dodge, Daytona with him, the judge with the big fin. And lo and behold, when I'm like in the 10th grade, he asked me out, you know. Well, I'm already in love with this boy from day one. And, of course, my father hated him, and for good reason. He dropped out of school. He was the ultimate bad boy. He drank and he smoked, and I was in love with this boy. And I was raised in an upper middle class family. We weren't rich, but we were upper middle class. And when his mother divorced the rich husband, she moved back to the projects, and he moved to the projects, and I'm still thinking, I love you. You're exactly what I need in my life. And we came up with this plan that if I got pregnant, my parents would have to let him be with me. Now, did we think about how we were going to support ourselves? No. All we could think about was we were going to have this little baby, and we were going to take this little baby down to spring break at Panama City with all of our friends, you know, and it's going to be a perfect life. So I got pregnant when I was 16 years old. Most people cannot, it was not an accident. It actually took me several months to get pregnant, but that was my escape plan. And so my parents, they talked about an abortion. I was like adamant, nope, not going to have an abortion. We're getting married. So we had the shotgun wedding. We got married. I was 3 or 4 months pregnant then. That was in 1972. I was a junior in high school. Like I said, I was a straight A student. I only needed, I'm an overachiever. Always been an overachiever. By the time I was a junior in high school, I only needed one credit to graduate, and that was government, which you couldn't take until you were a senior. So, we got married. Back in those days, you did not go to school if you were pregnant. Back in those days, you see it now, but not back then. So I only had one choice. If you're going to get married and have this baby, you've got to quit school. So that's what I did. And my husband decided that he wasn't that happy with me after all, you know. I think realization had, like, oh my God, she's pregnant with a kid, and there's like, you know, and we never even talked about how we were going to support ourselves, ever. So we lived either with his mother in the projects or my parents. And he was gone very soon. We were married for 2 years, but he was gone before my daughter was even born. He was there for the birth. But, so she never had a father figure. My dad was her father figure. My dad was my father figure. He was the only father figure my daughter ever had. But so when I was, I remember the night I brought her home, and my mother said, I will get up with her tonight, but I will never get up with her again or take care of her because you've made your bed and you have to lie in it. When she was 2 weeks old, my father brought me an application for a sewing manufacturer that had just opened in town. And I'm telling you this because I want to tell you this. I've never accepted or taken or borrowed a penny in my life, ever. The things my father taught me about taking care of myself and being responsible for my own actions are gifts to me in my life today. But I can tell you it was very hard. So I went to work in this sewing plant. I lied about my age. I was only 17. They found out, but by that time they promoted me to a supervisor. So what are they going to do? I already turned 18 by the time they found out I lied about my age. So I went to work when Carrie was 4 weeks old. And I don't even know how I did it. I have no idea how I did it. I worked a full-time job in a sewing plant. I think I brought home $50 a week, and her daycare was $25. My dad had bought a house for me to live in because my younger brother was still at home, and I was, according to my mother, disrupting their family. And so my dad bought me this house, and he put the down payment on. I had a mortgage, and it was $55 a month. I was responsible for paying the payment, my utilities, my daughter's daycare, utilities. I'd bought a little Volkswagen. that I had to make payments on. And there were many, many, many times, weeks and months, that I did not eat. It was all I could do to buy formula for my daughter. It was all I could do to buy baby food for my daughter. And I had way too much pride to tell my parents that I didn't have enough money for food. And so I did without. Now, every weekend we would go to my parents' house, and because I needed to eat. They didn't know that, but I went to eat. I didn't have anything to eat. And had my father known this, I can tell you that would have never happened to me. But I just, you know, I made my bed. I had to lie in it. It was my responsibility to support myself and my daughter. And in my head, there was no asking for help. There was no safety net. I knew that if I told my father that my boyfriend, my husband, beat the crap out of me, that he would have killed him. And so I kept everything quiet. My whole life I've kept it all here. You know, my whole life I've kept it on the inside. To this day, it's something I struggle with. Because I don't want you to think I'm weak. And I don't want you to think I hurt. And I don't want you to think I need you. And that's the way I live. So I was single until I was 28 years old. And I worked. And I worked in that sewing plant. And I finally got better and better, better jobs. And I'll tell you this. I've never applied for a job that I thought I could do. And I've never applied for a job I didn't get. So somehow, my dad always said, I remember when I was, after I had Carrie, my daddy said, "You've got a really big brain, and the only thing that's ever going to keep you from accomplishing whatever you want to accomplish is going to be you." And he had that much confidence in me, and he had that much unconditional love for me, that I was able to do things that I didn't think I could do. So I started building on a career and doing everything, you know, and I struggled, but then I married this guy that I dated for 2 years. He was 7 years younger than me, and I started dating him when he was a junior in college, and we married after he graduated. I was 7 years older than him, but he was only 11 years older than my daughter. And so there were like almost three generations in my house. Now, he didn't even try to parent my daughter because she wouldn't have let him anyway. And so I was responsible for working full time. And I will tell you this, this man loved me more than anyone's ever loved me before or since. And we were doing really well. I mean, before Carrie turned into an alien at the age of 13, you know, we were rocking and rolling, you know. And then my daughter turns into an alien, and I've got this teenager that I can't control and a husband who doesn't know how to help me. And the thing is they didn't like each other. And they were always wanting a part of me. Like, he would go if Carrie wasn't going. She would go with me if he wasn't going. So I was always in the middle. But we built two homes. He was a stockbroker. He became a stockbroker. He was a very intelligent person. And when we'd been married about 4 years, decided that we would have a child. I'd always wanted a child that had a father that loved that child. And lo and behold, I'm infertile. So we went through all these fertility tests and everything, and I finally got pregnant, actually four times. But here's what happened. What happened was, when I was 34 years old, my father died. And so that was my higher power. He was my higher power. He was the only sense of stability and unconditional love and always will be there for me that I've ever had in my life. The God I was raised with was a punishing God. I've heard this said in meetings. He was a cosmic peeping Tom. I had broken just about every commandment you could break. You know, I knew there was a God, but I didn't have a relationship with God. I don't know why. I guess because my dad was there. I don't know. But when my dad died, I was 34 years old. He was buried on my birthday. And I found out about 3 weeks later that I was pregnant again. And I knew that when I had this baby, it was going to be named Kelly. That was my father's first name. Boy, girl, didn't matter. It was going to be my, you know. And I really thought, okay, God's given me something I wanted for so long to take away the pain that I'm feeling over my dad's death. And when I was 6 months pregnant, the baby's heartbeat had stopped. And I had to give birth to a stillborn. And my world fell apart. I didn't want to cry. But I didn't know how to live life without my dad. And so over the next 6 years, I grieved. I actually had one more miscarriage after that, which was an ectopic pregnancy in my fallopian tube, which ruptured, which was the last chance I'd ever have at having a child. And I just started circling the drain emotionally. I'm going to go back to one thing. I drank when I was 14 years old. My first drink was a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. My second drink, when I was about 19, was a pitcher of Bloody Marys. I did. Alcohol was not part of my life, but every time I drank during all those years, I never had a stop button. But at that time, that alcohol was a hot stove for me, and so I would remember how bad, how sick I'd be. So I didn't drink anymore for years. My husband didn't drink, so alcohol was not part of our life. And if I'd gone to college and grown up with all my friends and all that stuff, you know, there's no doubt I would have probably become an alcoholic because it runs in our family, you know. But it wasn't part of my life until that last miscarriage. And my daughter had gotten pregnant about the time that I had my last miscarriage, and she got married, and her husband moved into our house, and she had the baby, and I was traveling. My career was in industrial sales at that time. So I traveled big territory, but whenever I would come home, I would have my husband wanting this part of me, my daughter handing me a crying baby. I'd hear about the fights they'd had while I was gone. I'd hear about how they hadn't eaten anything since I'd been gone. Seriously? I mean, you can cook, but they didn't. It was like everything waited for me to come home and put the pieces of our life back together every week. I traveled 3 weeks out of every month. I had a huge 7-state territory. And there was a time that I couldn't do it anymore. And I was down in Mobile, Alabama, and I had visited this little town called Fairhope, beautiful town. And I rented an apartment, and I went back home, and I packed my car, and I said, I'm leaving. And it absolutely destroyed my husband. What I should have done was I should have said, okay, Carrie, you, Dennis, and Chase need to get out and get your own place. I need to be here with my husband. But that wasn't even, you know, I wasn't even thinking. All I can tell you now is I look back and I see that I had a complete breakdown. I remember seeing him standing in the driveway with his heart broken, and I felt nothing. nothing. I just wanted to go away. And so I did. I moved to Fairhope. And then my daughter begged me to come back. I was living in Birmingham at the time, so I came back. And I realized what a horrible mistake I'd made. And I asked my husband if he would consider taking me back, and he said, "No. You've broken my heart. What would people think? What would my family think?" We were married for 10 years. We were together for 12. So I discovered alcohol. And I'm telling you, my drinking career was fast and furious. I drank from the moment I started drinking and figured out that alcohol made me numb. All bets were off. I became an alcoholic. I started drinking when I was 40 years old, and I can tell you that I was a full-fledged alcoholic by the time I was 42. I always thought I could drink really good because my dad seemed like he would just be drunk with one drink. Well, what I didn't know was he probably didn't drink a fifth before he came in the house, you know? But I'm thinking I can drink six and I can still walk and talk, so I'm not an alcoholic. I will tell you this, my father died sober. Unfortunately, he never had the benefit of finding the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I see so many qualities in him that I lived with, which was fear. I called it a worry wart. My brother told me once that why did he need to worry about anything that I was concerned about with him, because I worried enough for everybody, and that's true. I worried about everybody. I worried about everything. I know now today that I have an anxiety disorder. I know now today that because of some of the things that I haven't shared in this story that happened to me when I was a little girl, I also have PTSD. There are some things that I've only shared with a couple of people that happened to me when I was a child that I can see now looking back really made me a lot of the reason I was the way I was. And what it is, it's a guarding thing. It's keeping my walls up. It's keeping myself safe. It's pretending something doesn't happen, even though it happened, and just keep going forward and not being able to admit, talk about, or share with another person a lot of the pain that I've carried with me my whole life. Anyway, so I'm going to get to my recovery because that's what I really want to talk about. By the time I was 47 years old, my brother had been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 7 years. And I had seen this person change from this very selfish, self-centered, angry person to this happy, joyous, and free man. And I started drinking about the time he got sober. And we were thick as thieves, and we were so close. But I could see how his life was getting better and better and better, and how mine was getting worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. I had a very good job. Because I was afraid of being hungry again, I have saved every penny I could save for most of my life. As soon as I made enough money to save it, I saved it. And so on the outside, we looked a lot alike. I had a great job. I had a lot of money that I'd saved. And he had a great job. And he had money. And I had a beautiful house and a sports car and a great vice president's career. And we had the same things, but I'm going this way, and my brother's rising to the top, and I am completely dead inside. I'm scared to death inside that everything I've got, I didn't deserve, I will lose, and I wasn't good enough to deserve the things that I had worked for. I wish I had a penny for every $1,000 I've given away, because part of me felt like I didn't deserve it. I hate to see anybody hurt, but I'm telling you, I bail out people, and this has been up until recently financially. It's part of my life story, you know. But I want to read this because this was in one of the readings that I read every morning. And it was just so me. It was, comes from our sister program, Al-Anon. It's called, the book is Courage to Change. And it says, most of my life sped by in a frenzy of activity. School, work, projects, obligations all helped me focus forward. That way I didn't have to rest long enough to feel how frightened I was. There's nothing wrong with working hard and producing results, but I was abusing these activities. They were socially acceptable ways to deny my feelings. Both family and society supported my hiding behind them until, beaten down and exhausted, I reached the doors of AA. By that time, I couldn't have relaxed if I'd wanted to. I didn't know how it was done. That's exactly where I was when I walked into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had everything in the world to be grateful for, but I had no idea how to enjoy it. I hated looking at myself in the mirror. I was a isolated drinker. I drank half a case of beer every day. I drank at home. I worked from home. When I was not working from home and traveling and working with my specialist that reported to me, I would white knuckle it through my days until I could get to a hotel, and I never stayed at a hotel that didn't have room service and a bar, because I would walk in from that day's work and I'd order 6 Michelob Lights to be sent to my room. And while they were bringing it to me, I was filling up my sink from the ice maker and I was getting ready for my beer. And that was my day. I drank every day, every opportunity I had. And when I was sober, I can tell you I was never sober, because I always had a hangover if I wasn't drinking. I went to my brother. He had asked me to come to a New Year's Eve AA party with him in 2003. And I thought, I can do it. I can be sober for one night for my brother. And so when I was flying down to Orlando, I remember thinking on the plane, I'll never forget, it was Chautauqua Airlines, little bitty plane. And I remember sitting there thinking, something's going to happen. I didn't think we were going to crash. I just had this thought, something was going to happen. And I can tell you that I was drunk on the plane. I drank on the way to the airport. I drank at the airport. That was what I did. And when he picked me up, you know, the thing is, my brother never said you're an alcoholic. My brother never said you need help. My brother never said you're a drunk. My brother only showed me how happy this program made him. So when he picked me up, we stopped and got my beer as usual, and I drank a couple of them. We were watching Pirates of the Caribbean, Black Pearl, and I remember seeing 3 of Johnny Depp's. And I said, I got to go to bed. And the next morning, my brother woke up, and he found me in the kitchen, and I was pouring out my beer. And I said, he said, sis, what are you doing? And I said, I want what you have, but I don't know how to get it. And he said, are you willing to go to any length? And I said, yes. And he took me by the hand, and we went in. He was an amputee. Took me by the hand, he led me into the living room, and his living room, and knelt on either side of an ottoman, and he prayed for me, and he asked for God to remove the obsession of alcohol from me. And because I'm telling you, by that time I wasn't praying to anything. I did not have a conscious contact with any God, of my understanding or otherwise. And I was very angry at God. I was angry at God for taking my dad away. I was angry at God for causing my brother to have a motorcycle accident on the way home from an AA meeting and losing his leg. God doesn't do that stuff. And he went into his bedroom and he brought out a white chip and he said, 1,000 prayers I've prayed have just been answered. And he said, I want you to have this chip. He said, it's cracked and it's dirty. And he said, and I held on to it for dear life, and I want you to have it. That's what happened. So I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I get a sponsor. He told me to get a sponsor. I don't want a sponsor. I just want to stay sober. You know? He said, no, you got to have a sponsor. You got to work these steps. I worked the first 3 steps with him, and when I flew home, I told him, I said, Tim, I don't know if I can make it home without stopping at the beer store where I always stop when I fly home from work. And he said, call me and I'll talk to you until you get home. And he did, and he told me to find a meeting, and I did. And I asked a little girl who was 27 years old, I was 47, I asked her to be my sponsor. And the reason I asked her is because she got sober when she was 17. And that, something about that, it's like, how did you do that at 17? She had 10 years of sobriety and she was 27. And she had what I wanted. And I was 47. She was younger than my daughter. But I'm telling you, whatever that little girl said, I was like, yes, ma'am. We're going to go to the jail and we're going to take a meeting there. And I'm going, yes, ma'am. You know, you're going to do this work and we're going to meet at 5 o'clock. And I'm like, yes, ma'am. I've never been so teachable and so desperate for something in my whole life as I was when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got transferred to Atlanta when I had 9 months of sobriety. And I didn't go to meetings for a year and a half. I was did not like Georgia drunks. I did not like, first meeting I went to was a house place. I'm going, oh, hell no. Sorry, I just said that. But I was, you know, I went to a church meeting in a upper part of Birmingham where there were business people like me, you know. It's like, no way. And my brother, I talked to him like almost every day, and we would read the big book. And he told me, he said, sis, I'm going to Germany for a year. And he said, you got to get off your butt, get off your laurels, and get yourself back in meetings. He said, because I hear the alcoholic in you. Mm-hmm. So I did. Got back connected in AA. My life was rocking and rolling for many years of my sobriety. And by the way, I've known you since I've known him for 10 years. I've known a lot of y'all for 10 years. But my life was rocking and rolling. And I love to sponsor people. I've always sponsored people. My life was going exactly where I wanted it to go until about 2 years ago. And everything I thought about where my life was going to go was ripped out from under me. And thank God for all those meetings I'd gone to for all those years that I was going, and I didn't really need your help. I was really good. I was working. I was helping other people. I was doing all the next right things, but I'm telling you that my world was obliterated. And where my self-esteem, where my security, where all those things were standing, fear stepped right in. Fear stepped right back in. That's what this disease does. It waits for a weak moment. But I knew that the God of my understanding was never going to let me be alone. I knew that. I knew that however I got through what I was going to have to go through, I would have one more experience, strength, and hope to share with another alcoholic. I didn't know how that was going to happen, but those were the only two things I knew. And what that did was the women in this program, and several of them are here today, they held my head above water when I was drowning. I did not know that all those meetings and all those friendships were going to save my life. They saved my life. We grow through pain. I grew when I came in here because I was in so much pain. And I can tell you that over the last 2 years, I have grown more in sobriety and grown closer to God and my friends than I ever would have had it not been for that. So I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that my sobriety and my relationship with God, I'm grateful it was tested. I'm grateful it was tested because I know how solid my foundation is today because of it. I know how solid my foundation in this program and my friendships and my relationship with God. I know how solid that is now. I've taken meetings to the Cherokee County Jail for 2.5 years every Wednesday night. And the thing that I did when I was suffering was that I continued to go to meetings. And I can tell you that what I feel on the inside is not something that I show on the outside. And so nobody knew what I was going through except for my friends. But I kept doing the next right thing. And I started praying and meditating more than I ever had. And I kept going to the meetings at Cherokee County Jail, and I kept being grateful every time I walked out that knowing that I was able to at least give a little bit back of what I've been given. And it also reminds me every week of where I could be. It reminds me every week of what it used to be like. And I love those women at the jail. I love them. And I just kept doing the same things I'd always done. And I just kept doing what I needed to do. You know, there was a point in time that I became anorexic. I thought I looked good. But I had friends that were loved me enough to tell me that I was becoming anorexic. And that I needed to start taking care of myself. You can see I'm not anymore. I don't eat when I'm not happy. So look at my butt now and you'll see that I'm okay. But, you know, it's just that there's not one thing that's ever happened to me in my life as a child, as an adult, in recovery, out of recovery. There's nothing that I regret. I am one of those people that absolutely believes that nothing happens in God's world by mistake. When I came into this program, I was a victim of everybody and everything. I have come to learn that I am only a victim of choices I've made. I've made choices, and I've said this to sponsees as long as I've been sponsoring. Red flags never turn green. That's God trying to tell you something. Listen. And I'm a great advice giver, but I'm not so good at taking it from myself. Red flags never turn green. You cannot make someone or something turn out the way you want it to turn out. It's going to turn out the way God wants it to turn out. I hold no resentment. I hold no anger. I am happier today than I have been in years. And I feel God closer to me than I've ever felt in years. And it's only because I've reached out to Him. He was always there. I just wasn't ready. I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to be loved unconditionally after my dad died. You may know my last name. My last name is my dad's first name. I changed it to Kelly because I couldn't have that little boy or little girl named Kelly, but I could sure change my last name. It's easy, too. You just fill out some papers and you send them in and you got a new last name. There's no oath to take or anything. I mean, I did it back in 1990-something. I don't know. I've kept that name because my dad was my only unconditional person, the only person in my life that had loved me unconditionally. I guess I could change my name to God now because God loves me unconditionally, but that would just be a little bit freaky. Ginger God. I can see it now. But one of the things I will close with a couple of things. One of the things that I was told when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was that I got to make my own perception of what God looked like to me. And when I wrote down the description of what God would look like to me, it was every quality my father had towards me: unconditional love, always be there for you if you ask for help. You just got to ask. You know, I have a loving God today that I know is never disappointed in me. He may want more from me than I'm giving myself, but He's never been disappointed in me. I have a God today that I know is not going to punish me if I don't do the next right thing, because sometimes I don't. What a relief to find that kind of higher power, that you know you're never alone. I'm never alone. And I'll end with a story that I've ended with before when I've told my story. There was a man walking on a beach, and up ahead he saw another man bending down and picking up something and throwing it in the ocean. Bending down, picking up something and throwing it in the ocean. And he gets up closer to the man and he sees that there are starfish laying all over the beach. And he walks up to the man and he says, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, I'm putting these starfish back in the ocean." And he said, "Well, whatever for?" And he said, "Well, if I don't, they'll die." And the other man says, "Well, what possible difference could it make? There's millions of starfish out there." And the man looks down at the starfish he's holding in his hand and he says, "It makes all the difference in the world to this one." That's what this program does. This program made all the difference in the world to this starfish. That's why I share the message. That's why I go to the jail. That's why I reach out to the newcomer. Because someone saved me. And by the grace of God, I'm still sober today. Thank you.